Let's talk grand designs. No, not that sort of grand designs on the telly. I'm meaning the conjunction, and it's often quite clear, between architecture and megalomania. These things are often quite easy bedfellows to discuss, and to put this idea of boldness and scale in the architectural project, to put that into some sort of historic context. We're joined by design writer, author, critic Colin Bissett, friend of the program. Hello, Colin.
Hello, Jonathan.
It's almost synonymous with architecture, is it not? A sort of sense of grandness and ego.
Well, yes, certainly ego. I mean, certainly a lot of people will say that a lot of architects have a tremendous ego, but it's sort of not surprising that architecture is seen, has so many sort of egotistical projects, because there's a lot of sort of probing what is possible. And, you know, we see that in skyscrapers and things like that, the development of buildings. There's always got to be someone, I think, pushing for things to be done differently. And there's normally someone who says, well, not just a little bit differently, let's do it hugely differently and see if that can work. And often they'll come up with schemes that are just seen as absolutely ludicrous, but which, you know, perhaps in 100 years are seen as sort of relatively normal, you know. And that's what's sort of current now, I think.
Now, the idea, though, of architecture pushing the boundaries of the possible, has been a source of a constant over history and an area of great excitement in the built world.
Yes, I mean, often some of the examples that are often quoted are people like Etienne Boulay's cenotaph that he proposed for Isaac Newton, the physicist. Now, he proposed this enormous sort of dome. If you see it in cross-section, it's actually a sphere sort of held within a sort of plinth. This was in the 1780s. And there would be in the middle, there would be the sarcophagus of Sir Isaac Newton and this vast sort of space around him. And it looks amazing. It looks incredible. It's a beautiful artwork, even the blueprint of it. But it was not at all possible to make in the 1780s. But it exists. And Boulay was sort of known for his sort of what were seen as fanciful, often sort of spherical buildings that he came up with. But you do, in fact, start getting spherical buildings in the beginning of the 20th century. So, you know, he was just playing with an idea. But then you get people like Le Corbusier in the 20th century, who sort of came up with various plans one of his most famous plans, the Plan Voisin, which if you know the French, voisin means neighbor, but actually this was a plan that was supported, paid for by his friend Gabriel Voisin. This was a plan to basically demolish the center of Paris and replace it with skyscrapers in a park, so 18 skyscrapers, something like that, housing about 78,000 people. But the idea of sort of tearing out Paris, especially the Marais district, which was seen as, you know, it hadn't been done up by Haussmann in the 1850s, 60s. So he wanted to sort of get rid of the slums of Paris, which was also the Jewish quarter. So there's a lot of sort of, well, what's really going on here, clearing this area? But anyway, there's lots of commentary on that. But the idea of Paris being filled with skyscrapers, I mean, we look at that and we're still rather appalled by it, but it was
grateful.
A sort of, you know, but he also came up with a plan for Algiers in the 1930s. Algiers was still a French colony, and he came up with the plan Obus, which had various skyscrapers throughout it to make, you know, it a big city, a world capital. But he also had this huge snaking road going through it that was on top of housing. So there were 14 levels below it, which would have been housing and businesses or whatever. So the idea of having basically a motorway running through a city with this sort of exceptional sort of amount of sort of people living underneath it sort of made sense, but sort of ludicrous. You know, funnily enough, it didn't actually happen.
Yep. Frank Lloyd Wright is an architect who we would normally associate with a merging of building and nature, the affinity with the natural world. You have an example quite to the contrary.
I do. Well, I do. It's the Illinois skyscraper, which was just known as the Mile High skyscraper, which he proposed for the center of Chicago, because he thought this was sort of at the end of his life. He was proposing this. It was going to be sort of 1.6 kilometers high, and he thought, well, this is a great idea because it's going to stop the city being cluttered by lots of little skyscrapers. So having one huge one, well, that makes sense, doesn't it? You know, the idea of nature is actually there still, because his engineering was having the foundations like a taproot of a tree. So he saw it as a tree. And he'd used this idea in some of his smaller office buildings that he did in the 40s, like the Wax Johnson building. So this sort of central core going deep, deep taproot with cantilevered floors, something like over 500 floors. There were sort of about, I don't know, 70 lifts that were meant to be atomic powered. And how long would it have taken to get to the top floor? You know, and you wouldn't have thought, oh, gosh, I forgot to get the milk, you know, sort of down you go.
Manhattan is, of course, a place synonymous with tall buildings. But Buckminster Fuller had a rather challenging concept here.
Well, a lovely idea. I mean, I love Buckminster Fuller. He's a wonderful sort of utopian, sort of really wanting the best for mankind, I think. And he had invented in the 40s the geodesic dome, the sort of thing that has led to things like the Eden Project in Britain, or little sort of people's greenhouses, these lightweight greenhouses. He came up with the idea of covering central Manhattan with a geodesic dome, this sort of 3 kilometer diameter, this huge thing that would cover the whole thing, like a big bubble basically over the city. And that he said, well, it's going to keep the snow out, and clearing the snow costs an absolute fortune. So it's going to keep the snow out. We can purify the air. We can moderate the air quality within this. And you think, well, yes. And he actually came up with costings on it, and it really wasn't that outrageous. But it's very much the sort of realms of science fiction where we sort of imagine these sort of domes on distant planets, isn't it? I mean, it seems too fanciful. And yet we do have these sort of domes. We've, you know, got domes in Singapore that have gardens in them, and, you know, just being able to manage the climate. And maybe that's something that will become much more important with climate change.
Well, yes, I wonder if its time will eventually come as we seek to secure something habitable in an increasingly hostile environment. Looking at a quick survey of architectural extremity with Colin Bissett, and Colin, it'd be remiss of us not to, well, look at the darker side here, really, where architecture is a tool of the state, is a tool of, well, of intimidation often.
Well, yes. I mean, it is the architecture of intimidation. It's also known as the edifice complex. And Dan Sujic, the architecture writer, talked about that in a book about 20 years ago. And he was focusing in that book on projects in the Philippines for the Marcoses. And, okay, they're big, brutal sort of cultural centres and hospitals, and they look sort of like a lot of buildings around the world. There's also a rather gorgeous, in a way, place called a guest house for the palace, their palace called the Coconut Palace, which I've covered in previous icons, actually, which is all made from coconut wood. But it's the idea of all these grand projects being made with while the nation starves, basically, and often they're not actually used. They're just things to say, look how sophisticated, look how we are. But they're all about reflections. They're like the sort of Sun King with Versailles. It's like, look at how grand we are while everyone else is sort of, you know, looking for food. And you get this again with people like Ceausescu in Bucharest with the Palace of the Parliament now, his huge palace with just vast sort of amounts of rooms, 1,000-odd rooms, 14 stories, this hideous building, full of marble, full of crystal, full of all these things, and with a huge avenue going up to it. Well, I mean, avenues, they just clear the space, they get rid of communities, churches, you know, just move people out of the way so that they can have a view and a view to this grand building. And, you know, it's vile. It's totally vile. You've also got the, I'll say it wrong, the Rycheong Hotel in North Korea that was that huge pyramidal hotel that was started in the 80s but has never had anyone in it. It's just a sort of landmark now.
Well, I guess the ultimate expression here is, of course, Hitler's plans for Berlin.
Oh, indeed. I mean, the incredible, the idea of turning Berlin into Germania. And again, so using, it's this idea of constantly going back to the great sort of era of ancient Rome, ancient Greece, seeing these as the blueprint for how things should be. So the ceremonial, bringing in the ceremonial. And Hitler was already showing that in like the films of Leni Riefenstahl. But the idea of Germania with this, it was this huge sort of dome, the Great Hall, which would have taken something like 180,000 people in it, with a vast sort of avenue again, you know, and with the Brandenburg Gate and all of that in line, but lots of new grand buildings. So it really is the architecture of excess. It really is showing off in the biggest way, dominating everything around it and saying this is the right thing. We are the most powerful people in the world. And one of the most awful things of when they actually started sort of testing out buildings for Germania. And of course they needed quarries, they needed bricks, they needed materials for it. So they set up, of course, camps. And so some of the worst concentration camps were, you know, the people who were allowed to live in them, barely live, were going to work to create this huge, vulgar city, you know, horrible place. And very, very classical, even though Hitler had always sort of espoused interest in a sort of, you know, more folklore, more Germanic sort of Gothic idea.
Isn't that interesting, though, the classical reference which takes us back to ancient Rome and Greece and other civilizations of the time that expressed themselves in the grandest of their buildings. But that, of course, is made possible at the pyramids of Egypt by slave labor.
Yes.
There is that history of the brutality of these things going way back to that ancient precedent.
It's a link, isn't it? And I mean, all the sort of wonders of the world, the ancient world. I mean, they would just get people in the 20th century and probably in the 21st century trying to replicate that, seeing that as that's the blueprint. That's what we need. Why? Buckminster Fuller, I say.
Yes. we'll call it that. As we have said, his time may come. We may,
indeed,
in short order, have a world of geodesic domes, for better or for worse. Thank you for that overview of architectural extremity.
All right, pleasure.
Colin Bessett, design critic and writer and great friend of this program. There is a huge resource waiting for you at the ABC Listen app of Colin's icons compiled over years of this program. Do check them out.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.